I want to ask you a question. How many of you remember Mr. Magoo? Mr. Magoo? You know, it's a weird thing. See, some of the younger people are not raising their hand. Megan, I don't think you raised your hand. Do you know Mr. Magoo? Okay, well, that's good. It's a weird phenomenon that the older that I get, the more that my illusions and my memories and illustrations have to be explained because I'm aging and these are the things from my childhood. But Mr. Magoo is an iconic figure, and those of you who remember him, you remember the cartoon of the little old short gentleman, bald-haired, always very proper, wearing his hat and his overcoat and his cane, and the little slits for eyes that he had because he was so nearsighted that he was basically functionally blind. And the thing about Mr. Magoo that was so wonderful to watch and so entertaining was that wherever he went, he was completely oblivious to everything that was happening around him and everyone that was happening around him. And when he did see something, he usually messed it up. You know, he'd be going to a theater and he'd end up at the airport and get on a plane. And he had a dog named Bowser, but it was really a Siamese cat. And he'd be, you know, tilting at windmills and they were street lamps. And everything that he did was just comical because he was so clueless about his environment and about what was going on. The other thing that was maybe not so endearing about Mr. Magoo is that he would walk through your life and just create the greatest havoc and then walk right back out again smelling like a rose. He'd walk through an intersection and cars would be swerving and trying to miss him, crash into each other, and he'd just walk on by, you know, whistling a tune, and everybody's left to pick up the mess. He'd walk through a construction site and step on a lift and end up on the girders, and the girders would move just right, so right when he was about to step out into thin air, another girder would catch him, and he'd go on. And so Mr. Magoo could just sail, obliviously ignorant of anything through life, and yet everybody else was left to pick up the pieces. And quite obnoxiously, he would be the first one, if you were sitting in your smoking, crushed car in the intersection after he passed through, to turn around and say, "Buck up, boy, what's wrong with you? You know, you gotta look more positively at life." And you're saying, "Yeah, sure, that's easy for you to say." But here's Mr. Magoo just kind of sailing through, oblivious. Now, why am I bringing up Mr. Magoo? Well, last week, we talked about the pursuit of happiness. And we talked about it in terms of the metaphor of the promised land of the ancient Hebrews, that most of us are pursuing happiness the way the Israelites were pursuing the promised land from the point of view of the wilderness. And we talked about the fact that we set these goals, we set these standards and these criteria for happiness, and then we pursue them through most of our lives, thinking that when we get there, then things will be all right. When we get there, then we'll be happy. You know, and we defer. And the truth of the matter is that 90% of our lives is really quote-unquote wilderness. It's all the preparation. It's all the moving to. And we have these blips that represent the achievement of our goals or the occupation of the promised land that sometimes only lasts for a short while before we're looking at the next goal and the next thing that we do. And we talked about the fact that if you can't be happy now, you won't be happy then. You know, we talked about the fact that the promised land is really the land you're in right now. Once you realize that God has already given you everything that He has to give, everything that you need to be happy in this moment, right now. That happiness truly is not the pursuit of the promised land, but it's learning to love the wilderness in a very real way. So after that message, I was talking to Frank, and Frank said, "You know, I think that's the closest you've come to a positive thinking message, you know?" And I got a little defensive and had to explain myself right off the bat because that really wasn't the point, you know? And I understand what he was saying. And, you know, obviously some positive thinking is good. You got to fake it till you make it, right? And we've got to put the positive spin on this thing. But if it's just about positive thinking, that can be pretty superficial. If it's just about positive thinking, then what we're trying to do is be kind of Mr. Magoo-like and not see our reality, not understand our circumstances. But when we're oblivious to them, we can imagine and reimagine our world in any way that we want to, and we can walk through that. But is that really what is supposed to be happening? See, there are seen things and there are unseen things in life. And me can maybe be blissfully ignorant, going through just looking at the surface of things. But if we're really pursuing happiness, then we got to get down to the unseen things and start to perceive more and not less. And sometimes positive thinking is a veneer that we place over our lives. It's a band-aid over things rather than really searching down into what's going on. And not only that, to just come out here and give a positive thinking message can obviously trivialize some of the deeply disturbing things that are going on in certain people's lives. They have real problems. And to just be like Mr. Magoo and say, turn around and say, buck up, son, you know, is to completely misunderstand the depth of the problem. And so that's not what I was trying to bring across. You know, it's not an instant fix. We can't just change our thinking. Things have to happen, you know, have to happen over time and naturally, and not from the outside in, but from the inside out. There's a motivational speaker and an evangelist who has been getting more and more popular over the last few years, and I've seen some of these viral emails that go out about him, and I got one just last week, interesting timing, and I'd seen it before, but it was good to see it again, because this young man, I think he's probably approaching 30, he's around 30-something right now, and he was born without arms and legs, and you might have seen him. And when I say without arms and legs, I mean really, I mean there's just nothing, right at the shoulder, right at the hip. He's literally kind of a torso and a head, and it's amazing what this young man can do. And his state of mind, his attitude toward life and his circumstances, and it's launched this very, very successful career as a speaker and as an evangelist. He's speaking all over the world now. I liked him right off the bat because he was born in Brisbane, Australia. So that was it for me. Now he's living in California. But as I was watching this video, his whole thing is that we don't need to be limited by the cards that we've been dealt. And the video shows him, some of the videos anyway, show him playing golf. Imagine playing golf, you know, holding the club. Now, I've only seen him putt. I don't know how in the world he would drive, but at least he can putt. He's playing soccer, bouncing the ball off of his head, diving off of a diving board, and operating a motorboat, doing all sorts of things. And he can walk, and he has what he affectionately calls his little chicken drumstick, which is one kind of vestigial foot. But I've watched him turn pages in a Bible and read, and I've watched him play an electronic instrument, musical instrument, and actually play notes and drum sounds and all these things. It's amazing to watch him do all these things. And so the message to us is, well, if he's got those kind of problems, you know, my little problems are just insignificant. But that's not really fair either, is it? I mean, that's like kind of what my mother used to do, was compare me to the kids down the street or somebody else and say, why can't you be like that? Why can't you do that? And that's not what we're looking for either in terms of really fundamentally trying to change from the inside out. And if you hear this young man's story, when he was 8, 10 years old, he was suicidal. He didn't know if he wanted to live. He was considering all the things coming out of the blissful ignorance of his childhood into the reality of what his life was going to be like with these disabilities. But he got through, and by 17, 18 years old, he had developed this different attitude with which he was going to go through life. But I want to go a little different direction with this right now, and I want to call to your attention that every time I've seen him on video, he's already in the midst of things. He's already on the diving board getting ready to dive off. He's in the motorboat. You know, he's in this interesting seat that he was playing soccer in. And the question is, how much can he really do for himself? Can he actually climb up the ladder to get onto the diving board? Or does someone have to lift him up? Can he get in the boat by himself and start the engine? Or does he need help for that? They show him preaching to large groups, and he's got the little microphone, you know, that goes over your ear. Is he able to put that on himself? Can he brush his hair, brush his teeth? You know, the point is that he needs a whole cloud of people around him to be able to do what he does. He needs lots of help. I read somewhere where he now has a full-time caretaker because of his busy schedule. He is completely dependent on the people around him. You know, in another country, and certainly in another age, a baby like him wouldn't even have been allowed to live or would have been let die. because they weren't seen as viable in that culture. You know, thank God he wasn't born in China with the one-child rule. I don't know if that's the one they would have kept. And so he has all this dependence that he has to deal with. And here's what I think. I don't know what's in his mind. But I think that his real triumph was not that he was able to learn how to play golf or learn how to play musical notes or learn how to turn the pages of a Bible. His real triumph was learning to accept his dependence on everyone around him. How many of us are willing to do that? To accept the fact that we're dependent, to accept the fact that we're limited, to accept the fact that we need other people. And I think that is the source of everything that he has to give everybody right now, the source of his inspiration for so many people, especially young people. To accept our situation, to accept the help that we need. And this doesn't just go for someone who is just disabled. This goes for every single one of us. It's not to diminish his accomplishments at all. But I think if he is truly happy and not just a video icon, it's because he has accepted these things in his life. And then that radiates outward to everyone around him. I have a friend. I've been working with him for the last 10 years in a nonprofit organization. And I learned early on that he operates on a little bit different bandwidth, wavelength. He operates totally by faith, he says. And he always would tell me his mantra was, almost every time I saw him, you don't need to know, you just get up and go. In other words, don't plan. What are you spending all this time planning for? What are you spending all this time saving for? God's going to meet you. God's going to take care of you. You don't need to worry. You don't need to know. Just get up and go. You know? And then if I said the least little thing off that bead, he'd say, you know, worry is a sin. You know? And so I felt put in my place. And I get chided for these things. But through the years, guess what? If it weren't for people like me, people like him wouldn't be able to do what they do. Now, would they? You know, there are certain people who create the house. There are certain people who keep the umbrella over the party. Certain people who keep the roof on and the lights on that allow everyone else to be able to play and do the things that they do. And so once again, there has to be this understanding of how interconnected we are. That there are so many different ways that we can approach our lives, but they all interconnect. And not a single one of us is independent of everyone else. Think of all the things that you depend on other people for. And if you think that you're John Wayne, if you think that you're the Lone Ranger and you do this on your own, then the next time that you pour gas into your car, how many people did it take for that pump to actually dispense anything? The next time you go to the grocery store and there's something on the shelves, when you can actually put your credit card in and it allows you to walk out with something. You know, everything that we do, there are these unseen hands that make our lives so, make our lives the way that they are. And to think that they're not there is like Mr. Magoo walking through the countryside, leaving the devastation in his wake. So much interdependence, so much is going on here. And what we do is we tend to mix our spirituality with our personality. And we think the two are the same thing, and they're not. My friend has one spiritual personality, one personality, I suppose. And he connects that to his spirituality. He says, that's the way it's supposed to be. I have another one, and you all have your own. In fact, we as individuals all have a personal culture, don't we? We have a cultural way that we approach life and approach our spirituality, approach our church, approach our religion, and put two or more in the same room, and then they create a culture as a group. And churches and societies and countries and nations all have their cultures, all have their belief systems that then they codify in some way by the choices that they make. But if we're really going to be able to get down to who we are and understand that spiritually, we got to be able to separate the two. We need to be able to do that. And if we can't, then we'll never really understand which is which and which is what. Because spirituality is unseen. What do you do with that? How do we get a grip on it? How do we make it real in our lives? We make it real by the choices that we make based on what we believe and what we understand about our God. And those choices become our culture, our personal culture, and our culture as a group. You know, people that are so faith-based, people that are more charismatically, focused, people that are more intellectually focused, people that study a lot, and people say that you don't need any study at all. You know, all these different ways and focuses are part of this beautiful human family that we've got. We have to understand and start to separate. All religions and all churches create cultures around their beliefs and their belief systems. And they do that in order to make them seen, to make them concrete, to create edges and boundaries on them so that you can actually see what they are. And you can know what it is that you stand for and who it is that you follow and who you belong to as a group. We just need to remember that they're not the same thing. The group expresses their beliefs through their culture and through their choices. At the last church I was at, there was an older woman, and of course I was on the worship team, and I came off the stage at one point and was going out into the lobby, and she turned to me and said, "There won't be any electric guitars in heaven, I'll tell you that." That was her personal culture and belief, that was sacrilegious, that was not reverent, that was not what she expected and wanted to see in terms of the corporate worship. There are whole churches that are based on that. You know, churches have split and fought and literally come to blows with each other over whether you could have musical instruments in your worship, whether you could even have a piano, let alone a guitar. You know, there's some churches that believe all you can do is sing. That's the only instrument that God will accept. Others will accept a piano, but not an electric one. An organ? Okay, maybe that's all right. Hymns only, nothing contemporary. All these are stylistic cultural choices that we make. The Mormons come along and they make choices, right? They have certain dietary laws. They're not going to drink caffeine. They're not going to drink alcohol. Ever drank Postum before? That was the Mormon substitute for coffee. Not much of a substitute if you've ever had a cup of it. They had certain clothing that they have to wear, undergarments. They believed early on at the beginning in the 19th century that polygamy was part of their culture as well. Not anymore. These cultural things can change. These mores can change as we move forward. Jehovah's Witnesses don't celebrate birthdays. They don't celebrate Christmas. They don't celebrate Easter. They have no celebrations whatsoever. Why? Because they don't see them in the New Testament. They don't see them in the Bible. Therefore, they have decided that means we're not supposed to do them. It's a choice that they make. Seventh-day Adventists celebrate and worship on Saturday instead of Sunday because nothing in the Bible says that we are supposed to change. The church did in the second century, but they still celebrate on the seventh day instead of the first. Some churches, smoking, you might as well be committing murder if you smoke. You know, alcohol, of course, is not appropriate. Different types of clothing that are appropriate. All these choices we make are the culture and the way that we believe that we have to walk through our spiritual lives. And then, of course, if we take it so far as to think that we're right and everyone else is wrong, then we have the obligation and the justification to just impose that on everybody else around us. These are the ways that we try to make the unseen seen. But we need to understand that they're choices. They're things that we do. But they're not necessarily things that intrinsically have value. Last Wednesday in our class, we were talking about the ancient Hebrews and the way that they set themselves apart from the Egyptians and from the Canaanites. They were caught between Egypt and Canaan in the wilderness. They are leaving one culture and they are moving into a multicultural area that was their land that God was going to give them. And so Moses comes and he gives them a law. And the law included prohibitions. They were called toeva. And these prohibitions were the things that they were not supposed to do. And unfortunately, in 1611 with the King James Bible, they were translated as abominations. A terrible translation for us in English, because abomination means something to us that's very heinous, something that should not exist on the face of the earth. One writer said, like three-legged babies, oil-soaked oceans, and cheese whiz. things that should not exist on the face of the earth. And yet that's not what a toevah means. A toevah is something that is ritually unclean. It's like a taboo. It's something that a people chooses not to engage in, but doesn't necessarily have intrinsic evil. Interestingly, abomination, toevah, was trimming your beard, but slavery was okay. Polygamy was okay. You know, toevah was working on the Sabbath, but you could do these other things. And so these are the things that culturally people decide to do. And I think it was Mike who asked then, what should our boundaries be? What should our toevah be as a group, as a church? And that's a great question. Where do we set our limits, and which ones are important for us to carry through as we try to make the unseen seen in our lives, individually and in a group? And my question back was, well, what were Jesus' boundaries? What were his toevah? Because that is what we really want to know. We want to truly follow Jesus and understand where our boundaries should be set. And the best way to understand where Jesus' boundaries were to see him sparring with the Pharisees. Because the Pharisees were the religious leaders of his day. And they had taken their boundaries to the point of separation. In fact, Pharisee in Hebrew, perushim, means separated ones. And what they would do is they needed to stay completely separate and apart from anything that they saw as impure. Anything that they saw as unclean. And we've talked about some of these before. The Pharisees and all Jewish men would never talk to a woman in public. That was their boundary. That was toevah to them. And yet Jesus blew that one right out of the water, didn't he? He talked to women in public all the time. They would cross the street so their clothing wouldn't even brush against someone who was unclean. And yet Jesus would sit at table with them. He would seek them out. He would talk to them. He would ask them to follow him, even though he knew they were unclean, because he knew what they were doing. The whole town knew what they were doing, if it was a prostitute or a tax collector or anything in between. Pharisees would never enter the home of someone who was unlawful or unclean, let alone sit down and have a meal with them. Jesus blew that one out of the water too. Pharisees and Jews in general would never deal with a Samaritan. They would never deal with a Roman. They wouldn't be caught dead talking to a person of that ethnic background. And yet Jesus went out of his way to go and walk through Samaria on his way to Galilee and to talk to a woman at the well who was both a woman and a Samaritan at the same time, and then to talk to the entire village when they came out to be with him. His disciples were shocked. Jesus breaking more of these boundaries. To forgive an unrepentant person was against the oral tradition to the Pharisees. If a person didn't come and ask for your apology, not only were you under no obligation to forgive him, you were instructed not to. And Jesus said, of course, the exact opposite. How often do you forgive? Not 7 times, but 70 times 7 times. And you don't wait for anything. You just go and you connect and you re-establish your relationship with everyone. Heal on the Sabbath? Pharisees, of course, would not do that. Jesus went out of his way to do that, to make sure that everybody understood what was going on here. Jesus was about breaking boundaries. He was about moving into another person's life. Didn't matter who they were. Didn't matter where they were in life. He wasn't about separating himself. He was about connecting with them. So Jesus' culture was to break the boundaries between each other and not stay separated. Look at what he says here at John 13, 34 and 35. This is the scene of the Last Supper. He's just about to go to the cross, and he says to his friends, a new commandment I give you, that you love one another even as I have loved you, that you also love one another. And by this all men will know that you are my disciples if you have love for one another. I think that last line there spawned a song that I learned as a young Catholic. They'll know we are Christians by our love, by our love. All men will know that you are my disciples if you have love for one another. This is what Jesus is saying. Look at me. Look at the boundaries I break. Look to the extent I will go to bring you in, to accept you, to draw you in, to hold you to myself. That's how I love you. Now you go and do the same. He says at John 17, the glory which you have given me, I have given to them. He's speaking to his Father. That they may be one just as we are one. I in them and you in me. That they may be perfected in unity, so that the world may know that you sent me and love them even as you have loved me. This notion of glory is something we have to look at because it doesn't mean much to us in English. But glory in Aramaic, seba, or kavod in Hebrew, it can mean praise and honor. But the roots tell us that it means making the unseen seen, making the invisible visible. That's the notion of glory, seba. These unseen things are suddenly seen. Think about the Hebrews in the wilderness. God preceded them by day as a pillar of cloud and by night by a pillar of fire. They talked about the, we call it Shekinah, but the Shekinah, the glory that was visible around the tent of meeting. The glory of God was the unseen being made visible. And what is the unseen attribute of God? What is it about Him that we need to know? And that is the underlying unity of all things, the underlying acceptance of all things. What is Jesus saying here? He's saying the acceptance, the connection, the unity, the unseen attributes of you, Father, that you have given me, that I have now made visible, made seen in the lives of all of these, is what I have given to them. That glory, that acceptance, that love, that connection. That they may be one. See, Jesus' culture is about unity. The Pharisees were about separation. And I want to submit to you that all of our theologies and all of our cultural mores and cultural practices, what do? They separate us. They distinguish us. They put boundaries and edges around us. And even though that's necessary in a culture, every human family, every human group needs to have that. But if we think that that's the highest good, we're missing out what Jesus is trying to give us. He's trying to tell us, okay, that's fine. I'm not here to abolish the law. I'm here to fulfill it. And I fulfill it in unity. We're still going to practice it. We're still going to be who we are. We're still going to have our culture. But we're never going to stop there. We're going to break through that boundary and we're going to move to the next person. And we're going to see that even that person of a different tradition, of a different mindset, of a different belief is still us, is still human, is still someone that we can have relationship with, that we can be one with. This is what Jesus is about and the culture that he's trying to get across to us. It's not about seeing less, it's about seeing more. Our culture tends to put the blinders on. So like Mr. Magoo, we walk around in our lives, seeing only what we are trained to see, only what we allow ourselves to see, this much and no more. And we don't even see the damage that we create in the relationships around us. We don't see how everybody behind us is scrambling to try to put their lives back together and their cars back together, and things are teetering and they're pushing them back up as we pass through oblivious. We need to be able to break through those boundaries and see the people around us. One of my absolute heroes in the faith, who instructed me so much when I was young, just through the books that he wrote, was Thomas Merton. And I don't know if you know anything about Thomas Merton, but he, as a young man, he found himself in New York, needing to find meaning and purpose in his life. And through a series of spiritual revelations and experiences, he decided that his path was to join a Trappist monastery, which is a Cistercian order. It's a cloistered order. And he joined the abbey at Gethsemane in Kentucky. And he believed that his spiritual path was to withdraw, to move into the cloister, to move into a contemplative life where it was just him and God, and he would try to turn off the world, to leave the world behind. The world that he saw in New York was just too much. There's too much corruption, too much this, too much that. He couldn't hear the Lord's voice, and so he withdrew into the monastery, and he was there for 16, 17 years, writing and working and doing the things that monks did. And one day he got to go into the big city. They let him out of the cloister and he went to Louisville. And in a very, very famous passage, he had an epiphany at the corner of 4th and Walnut in downtown Louisville. And I want to read this passage. It's in your flyers if you want to read along. Because he found something out about breaking boundaries. He writes in 1958, "Yesterday in Louisville at the corner of 4th and Walnut, in the center of the shopping district, I was suddenly overwhelmed with the realization that I loved all those people, that they were mine and I theirs, that we could not be alien to one another, even though we were total strangers. It was like waking from a dream, the dream of separateness, of the special vocation to be different. Thank God, I am only another member of the human race like all the rest. I have the immense joy of being a man. As if the sorrows of our condition could really matter once we begin to realize who and what we are. The sense of liberation from an illusory difference was such a relief and such a joy to me that I almost laughed out loud. A member of the human race. To think that such a commonplace realization should suddenly seem like news that one holds the winning ticket in a cosmic sweepstake. I have the immense joy of being man, a member of a race which God himself became incarnate. There are no strangers. Then it was as if I suddenly saw the secret beauty of their hearts, the depth of their hearts, where neither sin nor desire nor self-knowledge can reach, the core of their reality, the person that each one is in God's eyes. If only they could all see themselves as they really are. If only we could each see each other that way, all the time. There would be no more war, no more hatred, no more cruelty, no more greed. I suppose the big problem would be that we would all fall down and worship each other. But it cannot be explained. There is no way of telling people that they are all walking around shining like the sun." He started out to separate himself. He started out to withdraw. But because he diligently searched for truth, he found it in the connection and not the separation. And I want to read you one last thing. And this comes from my journal. And it's dated Sunday, December 12, 1993. And just bear with me for a few minutes. Even close your eyes and picture the story, because it's just a story. "Last Friday began at 6 a.m. and ended at 6 p.m., and in between was San Francisco. My traveling companion was the president of a small company for which I'm consulting, and we were to give a presentation in the city. The storm was expected, and we were prepared for rain. It was good to be getting on a plane again. It had been a while. It was good to be up early and moving into the rain. All went smoothly at the airport. The plane was full and much more cramped than I was used to on longer flights, but I had a sense of peace about it, and everyone around me seemed to also. Deplaning was flawless. The presentation went smoothly as well, and afterward we realized we could either head back to the airport and stand by for the 1:30 flight back, or go have dim sum in Chinatown and try to catch the 3 o'clock flight. No contest. Stepping on the sidewalk, I was in another world. Hadn't been there since I was a boy holding my father's hand. There was a sense of unreality that I woke up in the morning at home, and in the space of half a cup of coffee and an orange juice, I was here in this alien land with this incredible jumble of signs and congestion. Chinese script, English words screaming from every available space. Cars and trucks weaving around parked cars and double parked delivery vehicles with flashers on. Pedestrians everywhere dodging through traffic, squeezing between sidewalk vendor displays and cars parked at the curbs. The noise, the hills, the breeze, the faces, the babies in strollers, the barbecued whole ducks and chickens and pigs hanging in the windows with the head still attached and sunken holes for eyes, dried shrimp and oysters in plastic bags, ivory and jade in a dozen colors, Chinese pinup girls, and somewhere Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer from a tinny speaker in Chinese. It was dirty and worn and confusing and absolutely beautiful. I don't know why I felt that, at least I didn't at the time. I was overcome with a sensation of life being lived all at once, all around me. And though I didn't belong and stood out in my business suit, I felt part of and at one with these people. I kept making eye contact with people I passed, and they smiled at me, and I smiled back. I laughed at some of the children I saw for no real reason. The food was wonderful. The duck and pig was simply pulled from the window and brought to our table, while deliveries of produce from the street were carried between the tables to the kitchens and back. Back at the airport, I kept catching people's eyes. They smiled, even at the small express terminal, packed and confused. With everyone standing by for a few precious seats, everyone was calm. Strangers smiled and talked. A girl asked us if we knew about a delay of our flight. We didn't. She was standing by, too. And when her name was called, she was so happy, I instinctively congratulated her with my hand on her shoulder. And she said now she would make a Christmas celebration with her family and smiled back at me from the tarmac on her way to the plane. And all this time, I just took it all in. I loved it, being there, being part of all these people, being surprised at my sense of well-being and theirs. And it wasn't until I was back on the plane that it started to form a whole, to tell a conscious story. Across the aisle was an Asian man reading a book. I immediately thought of him as being Chinese, but in recalling, he looked more Japanese. He sat very straight and erect, thin, in his apparent late 40s with thinning black hair, holding the book chest high, exactly centered in the pool of bright, focused light that the overhead panels throw down. He was so calm, serene. I watched his eyes flicking down the pages, precisely turning them. And then I looked at the book. It was in Japanese, or Chinese, the alien characters forming loose columns down each page. I watched his eyes start at the top right-hand corner and move down the column and then backward to the left. I knew that. I knew they read from right to left. But it never occurred to me until I watched him turn pages to the right that the books themselves read right to left also, starting from what would be our back cover. It was as if our two cultures looked at each other and said, okay, let's see how we can do things that are as exactly opposite as possible. And at that moment, I loved that man. I was so thankful he was sitting there all proper and serene. I wondered what he was reading, but it didn't really matter. All that mattered was that he was a man and I was a man, and though we had so obviously little to bind us, couldn't even share a book, we had our manness. I was proud to be a part of his race. It suddenly hit me that that was what had been happening all day. I recalled Merton's famous description of his experience at 4th and Walnut in Louisville, his moment of connection to humanity, and I knew exactly what he felt. It was a part of this vast, diverse, ancient, beautiful race, and I was at home in it. Where else could I be, would be, if I had a choice? I could celebrate my humanity by smiling into an Asian face on a street in Chinatown, sharing a woman's moment of happiness in a crowded terminal, watching a man read across an aisle, or watching my children grow with my wife at my side. I loved them all. And at that moment, almost equally, I needed them, and they needed me. Back on the ground, it continued. I was first off the plane, standing next to a woman in her early 50s. We smiled at each other. She asked if I had been waiting long. I told her I'd just gotten off the plane and was waiting for my partner. She was waiting for her husband, who had been gone for 5 days on business. Not as bad as last month, but bad enough. She moved to my other side to get a better view. We waited a long time talking, and when they came out, she ran to her husband. She could have been 17 the way she moved to him. And as they walked off hand in hand, she looked back to say goodbye with a wide smile. The euphoria of that day is now gone. But the experience and truth remain as I settle down once more to the quiet business of trying to live for you, Lord, in an unquiet life. But now, with the support of my billions of brothers and sisters who struggle alongside. We can make it as complicated as we want to. We can write all the rules that we want to and try to live by them and try to impose them on each other. We can even imagine that we're right and that God is pleased with us in all that we do. We can try to live like Mr. Magoo. Or we can begin to see the unseen truth of it all. That we are all connected, that we are all walking around shining like the sun, and that it's okay. Let's pray. Father, I want to thank you for your glory, for our opportunity and privilege and ability to share in your glory, in your unity, in your acceptance, that we can mirror that in our lives, that we can accept and connect with others in the way that you have done with us. Help us to see beyond our self-imposed limits. Help us to be able to see that these limits are not anything that you have necessarily set for us, that we can move beyond them even as we celebrate them and connect with everyone and anyone who's in our path. It is so important, Lord, that we understand what you are about, and you are about unity and connection and acceptance. Thank you for being that kind of God, Lord. In Jesus' name, amen. Amen. Let's all stand.